This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Hey, Mr. Battish, good morning.
Good morning, young man. How are you?
I'm just swell. That Excellent. Almost sounds like a doom and gloom forecast there.
Well, I don't want to get too doomy or too gloomy, but we want to keep people on their toes and let them know because we've been spoiled so far this winter.
We have. We've been lulled into complacency, I think. And we've got to remember, hey, this is January, pal. January in Chicago.
Yeah, and that snow that's coming in, it's going to be a heavy, wet snow. So, again, don't if you've not exercised for a while and haven't lifted a shovel since last year, just be prepared.
I'm telling you, you know, it's what we call the heart attack snow. Mm-hmm. And that's also the kind of snow where people, unfortunately, plug up the snowblower and then reach into the snout to try to unplug it.
Ooh, not good.
Oh, yeah. Don't do that. Yeah. Stick a stick in there or something. But
yeah,
you know, that last big heavy snow that came through the region, one afternoon in Milwaukee, there were two guys who died of a heart attack. And I remember seeing this story. Both of them, in both instances, these two guys were not cleaning their sidewalk or their driveways. They were both helping neighbors.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, it's just a reminder that, wait a minute, this stuff's going to melt.
Yeah. Eventually, it's going to warm up. We've got that El Nino, El Nina, one of those two coming through the area. I'm sure it's going to warm up in another week and melt everything.
You know, it's easy for me to say, because I must, in full admission here and confession, say that I'm headed to New Zealand before this day is out. So
You're no longer in the inner circle. You know what I'm saying? Wait a minute.
You're going to toss me right out, aren't you? It's summer there, buddy boy.
Oh, yeah.
I can't wait to get there.
That's going to be interesting. Wonderful.
We're going to get a good up-close look at the agriculture industry of New Zealand. And it is of great interest to some of the folks who milk cows in our part of the country because they compete with us in what has become, or what was anyway, for a while, a very important market, China. Oh. And I'll talk a little bit about that on the Saturday morning show this morning. Take care, sir. We'll talk to you a little later.
You got it.
Roger Battish in the WGN Newsroom. Max Armstrong here with you. Proud to say, starting off 2016 for me here on a live broadcast of the Saturday morning show. Orion Samuelson will be along. We'll hear what's on his mind with Samuelson Says coming up a little bit later in his commentary. But, yeah, we are going to New Zealand. I'm traveling along with some farmers this weekend over there to see the dairy industry. And, you know, in recent years, I mean, we've seen the meltdown of the Chinese economy and the ripple effect, the incredible ripple effect. First of all, we thought, okay, they're not going to buy as many soybeans from us. Turns out they're going to be continuing to buy, apparently, quite a bit in the way of soybeans, but maybe they're going to back off there. They're not going to be buying any corn for a while, and they don't need as much of the other stuff that they've been buying from the world because of their slowing economy. And, oh, my goodness, look what it has done and the ripple effect into our stock market in the United States. But one of the areas where they've curtailed imports is with dairy products, and they've become a very significant factor. Supported the United States dairy industry for many months, and we've continued to increase the size of the herd in the U.S. We'll find out in about 2 weeks, whether or not the U.S. dairy herd continued to grow in the month of December. But in the last report that came out, our production, milk production in the United States, was up 0.6% from the level of a year ago. And it comes about because of two reasons. We were milking more cows. About 29,000 more cows being milked in the United States compared to a year ago, and we're getting more milk per cow. If you look at the total production for the U.S., per cow, the output, 1,787 pounds a month. That was up about 4 pounds from the level of the year before. Well, in New Zealand also, they ratcheted up production to sell into that Chinese market, which, of course, is closer to them than it is for us. And that was a very big deal for them. And then, wham, the market has dropped significantly. Global dairy prices, The global dairy price, in U.S. dollar terms, between February of 2014 and August of 2015, dropped about 65% because of the increased supply and sanctions on imports into Russia and reduced Chinese demand, by all means. And while the prices bounced up some, they remain well below the long-term averages, and they are culling cows in New Zealand left and right. It's expected their dairy farmers are going to be losing money. 4 in 5 farmers there expected to have a negative cash flow for this year on into the latter part of this year, then maybe some recovery. But it roughly paralyzes what paralyzed some in the dairy industry because of global large supplies and then downward pressure on prices. Well, talking about prices, I visited this week with Bryce Knorr, who is with Farm Futures. He's an economist and analyst there and writes about a number of things of interest to the folks who farm, not only fertilizer prices and livestock prices, but grain prices, too. And he does a lot of survey work. He surveys farmers on what they think about what's happening and actually crop size. And ahead of the U.S. Department of Agriculture report that's coming out this next week with the final production figures for grains in the U.S. for 2015, I asked Bryce about his survey estimates of crop size. And here's what he had to say about that.
We didn't show big changes from USDA's previous estimates. Our corn crop came in at 13.57 billion bushels. That's around 85 million bushels less than USDA. We found slightly lower yields, but still very good yields, 169.1 bushels per acre, slightly lower acreage as well. For soybeans, we found 3.986 billion bushels, all-time record high, but only 5 million above USDA's last estimate. Yields down about a tenth of a bushel, still an all-time record at 48.2 bushels per acre. And we also found about 400,000 more soybean acres out there. We'll also inflate that total a little bit, but not huge changes. And the other reports out, the grain stocks, winter wheat seedings, also don't see really changing the fairly bearish dynamics that we've started 2016 with.
Grain stocks, especially bearish, right? Given the supply we have and the slack demand, I guess, especially in an international standpoint.
Right, and it's always difficult to interpret these December 1st grain stocks numbers, particularly for soybeans and wheat, where USDA juggles some of their numbers around, and particularly their residual usage estimate can make the implications fairly murky. Now, for corn, it'll give us at least some idea of how much corn walked off the farm, fed to livestock during the first quarter of the marketing year. I expect that number to be fairly healthy. Corn was cheap, and producers, I think, packed on the pounds as they tried to cope with rapidly falling prices.
Ethanol usage, that's pretty much locked in, is it not? The consumption number on ethanol, there aren't likely to be many surprises there, are there?
No, there shouldn't be any surprises at all, because we actually got the latest monthly number out earlier this week for November. So we have a pretty precise idea of how much that'll be. The export number is still a little bit foggy because we haven't gotten the census crush numbers. They'll be out, I believe, later. But we have a fairly good idea based on what the export inspections have been doing. The export sales and shipments for corn, especially, extremely weak. That continued again this week. Wheat also making a marketing year low in sales this week. That's not unusual for the holidays, but the trouble is they've been weak all year. Soybeans continuing to ship out a lot of soybeans despite all the trouble we've had on the river system. But, again, the sales there are starting to tail off as well.
You mentioned the fact that the USDA sometimes does a number adjusting routine to make things fit. Is this one of those reports where it's prone to happen, or does that happen more in the summer?
Well, it could happen with wheat especially. They can actually show negative usage for wheat somehow and kind of taking back what they attributed to feed usage during the summer quarter. So the wheat numbers are especially difficult to interpret. Typically, the soybean number, they start making those adjustments later in the marketing year. What we'll be watching for with this one, particularly with that residual use number, is whether it could be a tip-off that maybe the crop is a different size than USDA says in its other numbers out. We've seen that the last 2 years, where this December 1st stocks report has actually kind of gone against what USDA was saying on its production estimate for soybeans. So, again, making all of these numbers very difficult to figure out exactly what's going on.
Are these reports generated by different units within the USDA? Is that how you get different numbers, Bryce?
Well, I think they're looking at different things. You know, for the corn and soybean production numbers, they survey a lot of farmers, and so they get one survey there. For the grain stocks, they're surveying not only farmers but elevators, and there they can get an extremely close estimate because there just aren't that many people, and those people tend to keep very good track of their grain. So really two different survey approaches that they're using, and there's enough error built into each that it can cause us to scratch our heads quite a bit when we try to figure out exactly what they mean.
Some of the colleagues that you have in this industry of estimating and analyzing have been rather outspoken of their criticism of the USDA, as have some farmers, to be sure.
Well, sure. Everybody needs a whipping boy. You need somebody to blame when you're wrong. Now, I've been doing surveys since 1988, and in fact, the first time you ever interviewed me, Max, was back in 1988 when we did a survey of farmers' presidential preferences. And I think it was a surprising thing. They actually, some of them like Michael Dukakis, of all people, if you remember that. But I've been doing these surveys long enough that I have great sympathy for USDA because I know how hard it is to take a look at these numbers and try to figure out what they mean. And I think farmers are under the impression that people doing surveys just do a survey and you press a button and it gives you an answer. Well, you have to look at the data. You have to clean the data. And then you have to try to make adjustments because every sample is different. And you can come up with a lot of different numbers and try to pick out which ones may be closest. So there's a lot of science, but there's also some art involved.
Some subjectivity?
Yes. And, you know, because I'll generate maybe 10 different potential estimates, and I'll take a look at some of them. And, for example, you know, one of the numbers that came out of my computer put the corn yield at 179 bushels per acre. Well, right away I could tell that that was an outlier. That was just wrong. So I tossed that one out. Now, that was a subjective assessment, but it was based, I think, on kind of just a practical consideration. So there are a lot of things that go into these estimates that can introduce error and that can make it a fairly difficult process. And a lot of the people who are criticizing USDA, of course, have never done a survey, don't do their own surveys, and have no idea of just what's involved with it. And Farm Futures, frankly, is one of the few organizations anymore that actually surveys farmers for their production estimates.
You are already looking ahead toward the crop that growers will produce in 2016, but the survey coming up fairly soon, I guess, of what farmers will be seeding. Now, you start estimating that actually in August, do you not?
Right. We put out our first estimate at the Farm Progress Show, and then we'll put out another one at our Farm Futures Summit that begins January 21st in St. Louis. We have a two-day event preceded by a one-day financial boot camp for growers who want to beef up their financial prowess. That's put on by the Farm Financial Standards Council. Then the next 2 days, we'll be taking a look at a variety of things, from marketing and risk management to financial management, farm transition, a lot of different issues, two full days of panels and presentations.
Yeah, two full days. That's the Farm Futures Summit. Bryce Knorr there talking about it. And that summit will be taking place in St. Louis, down there at the Union Station Hotel. I think you can still sign up for that. I tell you what, I know a lot of you growers listening have so many things on your minds about making how things can be penciled out here to make it work in this very difficult economy. And I've been to this Farm Futures Summit several times in the past. I've sat in the audience. I've moderated programs there. It's just loaded with information. And over the course of the 2 days there, you'll learn a lot of stuff you can take home that you can apply in your particular individual operation, finance strategies, growth strategies for your business. There are sessions for young farmers. There'll be a technology session, too. That's the 21st and 22nd of January in St. Louis Farm Futures Summit. And if you have an interest in that, you can see the agenda, and you can also sign up at the website farmfutures.com. And if you want to go straight to it, you do farmfutures.com/summit for all of the information on that. More coming up here on the Saturday Morning Show on WGN Radio. You know, the federal government on a regular basis tells us what we should be eating and what we should try to not eat as much of. The dietary guidelines, they call them. They update them every 5 years. And they're put out by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services. And really, it's kind of a foundation for federal nutrition policy, and it shapes the recommendations that the U.S. Department of Agriculture puts out, their My Plate recommendations. And it was interesting when they came out with the dietary guidelines the other day. They said, eggs aren't bad for you after all. But sugar? Now, that's a different story. And there was immediate reaction, of course, from the various agriculture commodity groups. The dairy industry said they like what they saw in the dietary guidelines, and they said milk, cheese, and yogurt are important answers to the question of how Americans should change their diets for the better. The dairy industry made that point, and they said, yeah, the guidelines are right on here with what they're saying about dairy, milk, and dairy products. The beef industry, they liked what they saw there, too, and they were complimentary of the dietary guidelines. Now, the Sugar Association, they weren't so happy. They said the dietary guidelines for Americans are too important not to get them right. The Sugar Association said it was disappointed that despite a lack of scientific evidence, in their words, despite a lack of scientific evidence, the 2015 dietary guidelines for Americans recommend an intake limit or a target for added sugars of no more than 10% of daily calories. The sugar industry is in quite a bit of turmoil, especially the beet sugar producers. You know, they grow sugar beets in, over in Michigan and up in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Idaho, and all of them switch to genetically modified sugar beet production in order to increase the yields and to cut their costs of production. And lo and behold, here we have Hershey saying, guess what? We're not going to use anything that is a genetically modified product. Hershey, of course, being an international manufacturer of candy products, and that has really concerned the folks in the sugar beet industry. So far, I believe Hershey is the only national brand that has dropped beet sugar, but could this spread quickly? And here's the real concern for the sugar beet producers. It would take a while to build up enough non-GMO seeds. It would take a couple of years, and by then, many of the sugar beet farmers might be out of the business altogether. So it's going to be interesting to watch what happens to them. There's more coming up on the Saturday Morning Show. Hey, Roger, do you tweet?
Yes, I do, quite a bit.
I should pay more attention. Maybe I'm not following you. I surely am following you.
Well, I see your stuff because I love your morning report.
I'll do a better job of...
well, it's Teacher RB. I don't use my regular name. In fact, I had to change it once because someone hacked my account. So I got hacked.
There's one that's very close to mine that has a lot more followers. There's Max Armstrong 1. And that's Lance's boy.
Oh.
The kid has probably, and he might have 20 million followers. I don't know. I only have about 8,000 or so, I think. But, yeah, I do post stuff there from time to time about agriculture. And, when I'm on the air at WGN, sometimes I post. And I've been known to post a granddaughter picture now and then.
Now and then, yes. A proud grandpa.
I can't help that. I know. That's in the job description, I believe.
It is. It is. Unless, of course, the daughter or son has restrictions. Now, see, I have some restrictions.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, I'm not allowed, unless I get special compensation, to go ahead and put their pictures on. And I abide by that. I was allowed to use their faces in one of those jib-jab cartoon things.
Right.
Where I think the whole family was dancing around the Christmas table or something like that.
I see.
But that's okay. I'm okay with that. Because
I'm... We lowered some of the barriers during the holidays a little bit. You know, it's our way of sending Christmas greetings, I guess.
Well, of course, of course.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate so much the chance to visit with you. Have a good weekend.
You too, sir.
Roger Badish in the WGN Newsroom. Max Armstrong with you here on the Saturday morning show. And a regular feature here is Big O's Commentary, Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products.
Welcome to Samuelson Says. Hello, everyone. I'm Orion Samuelson, this week with a message to my friends in Iowa. I feel sorry for you.
If you're tired of your clothing being ruined by a spill or a stain, now there is hope. Thanks to Wink Wash Away Laundry Stain Remover. This easy and safe to use pre-wash stain remover is a must-have in the laundry room for all washable, color-fast fabrics, including wool, cotton, synthetics, and even cashmere. And for those unexpected stains when you're on the go, watch them vanish with Wink Instant Spot Remover. Check them out at www.whink.com.
Now, with this week's Samuelson Says, here's Orion.
I received an email from a farmer in Iowa a few days ago, and he wanted me to announce to my audience that anybody looking for manure should come to Iowa. They've got more than their share. And he was not referring to the real product. He was referring to what they've had to put up with for the past several months with all of the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates visiting the tall corn state. And it makes me wonder how you get anything done in Iowa every 4 years as you approach your voting time, because that's all you have to listen to. I have to tell you, I have not watched or listened to one debate, because they started that a year and a half before the election. And all you have to do is look around the world these days, and you never know what the next day will bring in the way of a terrorist attack or a meltdown in currency, such as we have seen this year in China, and all of the different items that can have an impact on who I would vote for. And I'm sure between now and Election Day, there'll be a lot more taking place. The thing, again, that I come back to, the billions of dollars spent to get our votes, much better used at food pantries and helping people who really need it. The other thing that gets to me is the fact that candidates spend all their time attacking the other candidates. They don't tell me what they will do to make this country better and my life a little easier. And then I'm also bothered by the fact that so much of what the candidates say cannot be backed with facts. So one more time, I would suggest that we adopt election procedures found in other countries, where they declare Election Day 1 month in advance, or in the United Kingdom, 3 months in advance. If you can't convince me in 3 months, or even 1 month, that I should vote for you, then I'm not sure you deserve my vote. And I, frankly, am tired of all of the attacks on the other candidates. Let's talk about what you can do to fix this country. And Iowa, I hope you survive. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
Saturday morning show on WGN Radio Chicago. Max Armstrong. Yeah, short naps are nice, aren't they? Hey, stay alert, pal. There was enough dead air, you could have driven a semi through there. Orion Samuelson has been taking a little time away, and he deserves it to rest up a little bit. He's been to the Valley of the Sun, and he will be traveling this next week to join Farm Bureau members from all over the United States. Well, hey, Big O, come on in here and tell us what you've been up to.
Well, Max, just like the uncertainty of the market this first trading week of the year,
there was a lot of uncertainty about weather here in the Valley of the Sun. I arrived in Arizona on Christmas Day and will be leaving later this morning to get down to Orlando for the American Farm Bureau Convention. But the weather in the Valley of the Sun, I've been coming here for the Christmas vacation for a couple of decades and have not experienced as long a spell of cool weather and then wet weather at this time of the year as we've had this week. Now, farmers and ranchers are delighted. I talked to Andy Grossetta, my cattleman friend up at Cottonwood, about 100 miles north of the valley, and he got over 2 inches of rain during the rain this week because it started raining Sunday night, and it didn't quit raining until sometime during Friday morning, and it produced a lot of rain. In downtown Phoenix, it produced up to 2 inches of hail, and I talked to people who couldn't remember when that happened last. I certainly couldn't remember, but the moisture is welcome if you're not a football fan, a golfer, or a tourist, or a vacationer. And of course, the Valley has been full of football fans since we arrived. Green Bay Packer game, we had the Fiesta Bowl game, we had the two or three other bowl games here in the Valley. And now, come Monday night, we have the college championship. And so, as we get ready to depart Sky Harbor Airport, there will be thousands of other people coming into Sky Harbor for the events leading up to, and then, of course, the championship game on Monday night. But during Christmas week, I had the opportunity to spend a day at the Arizona National Livestock Show. It's a fascinating show held during Christmas vacation because schools are on vacation. That means FFA and 4-H kids can come to the show with their cattle, their hogs, their sheep, their poultry. This is the first year they've had poultry at the show. And it was interesting to watch these youngsters at work in this time of the year. A good turnout for the show, not only from the Phoenix metro area, but a lot of vacationers from the Midwest who come here for winter weather, and that's warmer and drier than we had. But they were here to do what they like to do, go to a livestock show, I guess. And so a lot of them in the Midwest can't do that, of course, in the wintertime, but here in Arizona, you can. And talking to cattle ranchers, yeah, there is concern about the cattle market, and there was hope on the part of many of them that we would get away from some of these down limit moves that we've seen in the cattle market the last 2 or 3 months. But again, this week we saw one day where live cattle and feeder cattle were down limit. My friend Andy Grossetta, incidentally, who has about 400 cows on his ranch, for him, calving season started the week after Christmas and is picking up, of course, as we move on into January. Well, looking ahead, Max, I'm looking forward to going to the Farm Bureau Convention and watching something that you and I haven't seen for 16 years, the election of a new national president, with Bob Stallman deciding last summer he would not seek re-election. So that's certainly going to make for an interesting convention. And then looking ahead to next Friday, I'll be at Grand Rapids, Michigan, for the annual meeting of the Michigan Association of County Fairs. I last visited them over a decade ago, but they've invited me back, and I'm looking forward to that. And then later in the month, while you're off to New Zealand, I'll be off to Bismarck, North Dakota, for the annual meeting of the Northern Pulse Growers, and then from there to San Diego for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association annual convention. Busy time for meetings and farm shows, and you and I know, look forward to covering as many of them as we can. Have a safe journey to New Zealand, and we'll see you when you get back.
All right, Big O, thanks. Appreciate it so much. Yeah, he'll see a lot of the farmer friends of ours at that Farm Bureau meeting, and he was talking about the election. That is going to be a big deal there because it doesn't happen often. In the past 30 years, the American Farm Bureau, which at one time was headquartered here in Park Ridge, but then moved to Washington. In the past 30 years, they've had only two presidents. So the election of an individual to run that to the most influential and largest of the farm organizations in the country is always a kind of a much-watched process. There are four individuals who've declared candidacy, the presidents of the farm bureaus in Oregon, Arizona, Georgia, and Indiana. And the conventional wisdom from the folks who watch this is that it's pretty much between the president of the Georgia and Indiana farm bureaus, because the membership really is more sparse. The membership of farm bureau is more sparse in the western part of the country. And there are a lot of members in Farm Bureau in the South and Southeast. Big membership states are Tennessee, North Carolina, Kentucky, for example. But Don Vilwalk, who is head of the Indiana Farm Bureau for quite a few years, a friend of ours, is considered to be a very strong possibility as the next Farm Bureau president in the United States. He or Zippy Duval, who is president of the Georgia Farm Bureau. A few weeks back during the fall, I talked with Don Vilwalk about running for that post at the American Farm Bureau Federation and the key issues. He's been traveling a lot, talking with farmers and ranchers all over the country. And I asked him, you know, what he's hearing about the most, what people have been telling him and really sounding off about.
Well, wherever I travel across the country, it's always WOTUS, Waters of the United States, the Clean Water Act. It depends what you want to call it, but the EPA has really riled up farmers and ranchers across this country. I say it's the biggest land taking in the history of the United States. It's just unbelievable what they're trying to accomplish and really take property rights away from farmers and ranchers that truly, really care about their property.
There was a critical judge's ruling the other day. A federal district judge ruled on that against Waters of the United States. How much comfort, how much relaxation can agriculture take from that decision?
Well, I think it's a positive step. It wasn't all states, unfortunately. We're trying to get injunction nationwide. American Farm Bureau, the other commodity organization, the livestock groups have all joined together, going to court, hopefully, to get that injunction. Trouble is, we're up for a potential $37,500 a day fine, and we don't know what the rules are. If a farmer wants to move some dirt today, they really don't know where to go to get the answers.
Have you ever seen, in your years of experience with farm organizations, when farm groups have been more unified, more together on an issue? Rarely have we seen this to this degree, right?
It really has unified us all, and I think, one, that's a good thing. It shows we can work together. That's the one of the things of my candidacy I talk about. We've been able to do that in Indiana, to get all the groups together, working together, and I just really think that's important nationally as well. So this might be eventually a good thing that unites us.
On the national platform, you would be, as Farm Bureau president, working with Congress. And rarely has it been as challenging, it seems, to work with that bunch with the partisanship we see there. What's our hope in rural America to be able to continue to be having some influence there, to be having some effect on national policy and laws?
Well, it is difficult, and the demographics is against agriculture. We're a dwindling number, but I'm really proud to say all the years I've worked on the Hill, we have earned the respect of the Hill. Quite often we have great relationships. Really, for the most part, a lot of things they do on the Hill are not partisan. They're really about agriculture moving forward. We've got some great committee chairmen and have had for a number of years that understand that. So we've been blessed, but it's some of these overarching things and problems we have in this country that are really concerning to all of us.
An election year just ahead. I suppose it'll be difficult to see much progress there in terms of getting things done in Congress that need to be accomplished, but it also doesn't it present an opportunity for farmers as we're ramping up toward elections to say, wait a minute, this is something that matters to me?
Well, it really is. It doesn't hurt to run all the candidates through Iowa. What better ag state for them to make a pledge or make a commitment? I think that's very important, and our Iowa friends do a great job. But it's really important for farmers and ranchers to get engaged with these candidates, to get them on the record, to let us know how they really feel and What would they do with WOTUS if they had an opportunity? What kind of EPA administrator are they going to appoint? So now's the time to strike. It's now the time to visit with them and see if we can get some positive commitments.
What do you say to that farmer out on the rural route? No doubt you've been asked sometime or another by the farmer in Montgomery County, Indiana, or Elkhart, Indiana, wherever it may be, who said, what can I do? I mean, I'm just one out here. I can't make a difference.
Well, really, that's one of the keys of my campaign is we have to empower and educate those county members to give them the tools so they can communicate. Yes, I'd like to think the American Farm Bureau president can move mountains, but that's not the way it works. It's really a local farmer or rancher that communicates with the movers and shakers in their state that make a difference. So if we give them the tools and the information, I'm confident they can do that, and hopefully we can work on that.
Indiana farmer Don Vilwalk. He lives and farms a couple hundred miles south of Chicago, Edwardsport, Indiana. But he's been all over the state of Indiana and, many other states, too, in recent months, seeking the candidacy of the American Farm Bureau. Graduate of Purdue University, very knowledgeable, and would be certainly a good president of Farm Bureau if the members so choose at their meeting coming up, where Orion will be joining them. There was some news this week on the GMO front. Genetically modified organisms, Campbell's soup, saying day before yesterday they'll label all of their U.S. products for the presence of ingredients derived from genetically modified organisms. And really, they're the first major food company that has caved in to the calls from consumers to have a little more transparency about ingredients. I mean, if you look at the other major food players, big companies such as PepsiCo and Kellogg have resisted these calls. And there's been a lot of money spent to defeat GMO labeling ballot measures in individual states, Oregon, Colorado, Washington, California, because they fear that it would add to unnecessary costs for the food industry. Also, it seems kind of silly to do it on a state-by-state basis. It's like dividing this country up into individual countries when it comes to food law. But several activist groups have been pressuring food companies to be more transparent about the ingredients, especially GMO-derived ingredients in Campbell's soup, of course, which produces Pepperidge Farm cookies and Prego pasta sources. Said it will take that step and will label all of its products for the presence of genetically modified organisms, notwithstanding the fact there is no proof, no sound scientific evidence by any peer-reviewed, third-party peer-reviewed, reputable institutions that GMOs cause any harm. But the question has been raised in the minds of so many consumers that this push toward labeling continues. And that story will continue to be a big one for food and agriculture in 2016. Another interesting report I share with you this morning from Carnegie Mellon University. And this one got my attention, that vegetarian and, quote, healthy diets are more harmful to the environment. Carnegie Mellon University doing a study that says, you know, you've got all these recommendations to consume more fruits and vegetables and dairy and seafood. But Carnegie Mellon says it's more harmful to the environment because those foods have relatively high resource uses and greenhouse gas emissions per calorie. Now, this was published in Environment Systems and Decisions, and the researchers at Carnegie Mellon found that, and this is Paul Fishbeck, who is a professor at Carnegie Mellon, says eating lettuce is over three times worse in greenhouse gas emissions than eating bacon. Paul says a lot of common vegetables require more resources per calorie than you would think. Eggplant, celery, cucumbers, in his words, look particularly bad when compared to pork or chicken. Specifically, they examined how growing, processing, and transporting food sales and service, and household storage and usage take a toll on the resources in the form of energy use, water use, and greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, on one hand, they say the results show that getting our weight under control, eating fewer calories, has a positive effect on the environment and reduces energy use, water use, and greenhouse gas emissions. from the food supply chain, but eating the recommended, quote, healthier foods, a mix of fruits, vegetables, dairy, and seafood, increased the environmental impact in all three categories. Energy use, they say, went up by 38%. Water use went up by 10%. Greenhouse gas emissions up by 6%. And they say there's a complex relationship. It's very complex between diet and the environment. What is good for us health-wise, they say, isn't always best for the environment. Again, that's according to some of the research done at Carnegie Mellon. There's more coming up on the Saturday Morning Show, and we'll catch the news momentarily, too, here on WGN Radio. Hey, thanks for joining us on the Saturday Morning Show. Special thanks to Bob Ferguson, our engineer, Max Armstrong, here on behalf of Orion Samuelson. Hoping you have a great weekend. Hey, Veronica Carter, how are you, kid?
I am fine. Long time no talk, and I'm so glad to get to work with you again.
It has been a long time. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, this woman has the best voice on the radio.
You know, you are one of my biggest supporters, and I thank you for it, Max.
You know, I've said you could read the phone book to me, and I would just listen for
what? Grandpa, what's a phone book?
I won't do that just because that would be boring, but thank you.
No, I would love it. You know, mentioning phone books. If you go through, and I don't know if there are any at O'Hare, but at Midway Airport, the far north end of the terminal at the lower level, I think it's up by, what is that, gate or door four or something like that, there's a whole battery of phone books.
Why?
And telephones.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there must be like eight
coin
phones there. And they're also clean and untouched. Nobody's
Every once in a while you see on like Facebook or something, someone will take a photo of a phone booth because they just aren't around anymore.
Oh, I've done that a couple of times in the
back
past
in
year.
My day.
Yeah. What was that thing? Well, thanks so much. Hope you have a great weekend. Appreciate it. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.